So, yes, so we're doing a series of talks on these urban retreat evenings. This is the fourth one. But don't worry if you have missed all the ones so far. I'm hoping to make this talk sort of speak for itself. But also, you can listen to the other ones. They're all recorded and you can look them up on our website. And the talks are all sort of based around or sparked off by this image, this image of a wheel in the jaws and claws of a monster. And yeah, as Garbhavati was saying to those of us in this room just before the tea break, this image is an image of the unenlightened mind, the unfulfilled mind. So this is an image of the unfulfilled mind. And it's yeah, there's so much to say about it. It's a very complex image, as you can see, in contrast with the image of the Buddha, which is the fulfilled mind, the enlightened mind. So yes, so the characteristics, one way of thinking of the unenlightened mind, the unfulfilled mind, the characteristics are that it's conditioned when to the extent our mind is conditioned, to that extent it's unfulfilled and unenlightened. And by conditioned, I mean that it's just in a series of knee-jerk reactions to what life throws at us, yeah. So all the time, anytime we walk down the street or whatever, all sorts of sense impressions and information's coming to us, and most of the time we're just reacting in a knee-jerk kind of way to that, in small and big ways, loads of small ways. Like, you know, you walk down the street with one intention, and then you know, you're suddenly, before you know it, you're inside a shop buying something that you didn't think you wanted. You know, you didn't even know you wanted. You know, you sort of find yourself in these situations. You think, oh, how did I get here? We do that in small ways, but kind of tragically, we can do that in bigger ways as well. We suddenly think, God, like, how did I end up here? You know, how did I never, you know, you can't. You didn't really choose. I don't know, even quite big things in life, like whole jobs, even whole relationships, even like whole life situations. So that's one characteristic of the conditioned, of the unenlightened mind. It's conditioned. It tends to repeat itself. Again, that's what happens. Often again, it happens in relationships, and I don't know why that's kind of come into my mind, but so often, you know, you think, oh God, how did I end up kind of with this person again, as it were, you know. It's sort of, we're in the same scenario, you know. How did that happen, you know? So we sort of, or other sort of similar, we think, that's familiar, you know, this is familiar. And then you gradually realize the sort of common factors, like me, you know, you can't. Yeah, so it's repetitive, it's predictable. As I've been saying during the week, often we notice these characteristics of the unenlightened mind more in other people. Quite hard to notice them in yourself, quite easy to notice them in other people. We can often, you know, when we know somebody quite well, we can often sort of predict what they'll do. So yeah, so that is that's all this very complex image there is in sort of pictorial form, trying to show that kind of reactive mind. It's driven by greed, hatred, and delusion. So in the very center of the wheel, again, as Garbhavati was saying, there's three animals biting each other's tails, a pig, a cock, and a snake. And they're representing greed, hatred, and delusion. That's what keeps the whole thing going. And I'll say a bit more about that in a minute, because it sounds a bit quite strong notion, greed, hatred, and delusion. Sometimes we think, gosh, well, I'm not hateful. You know, we might get a bit irritated now and then, but I'm not hateful. But hatred in Buddhism covers that whole spectrum from mild irritation to kind of out and out hatred. And actually, it's a funny thing about meditation. You both. In meditation, it's almost like two trends happen at once. you learn to be less hateful, but at the same time you realise how hateful you are, if you see what I mean, both at the same time. Like, I know when I first came along to the centre about, 32 years ago, whenever it was, I didn't really think I hated anyone. It didn't take long for me to realise that actually I was much more full of ill will and hatred than I had previously admitted to myself. And in a funny way, that was progress, seeing that. So at the same time, it's progress to try and transform it. So you're both trying to transform it and realising it more and more. So anyway, that's what's driving this whole thing, this whole mind of that's the unenlightened mind, and yeah, the other thing is that the unenlightened mind just keeps creating worlds, and while we're driven by greed, hatred, and delusion, even our best efforts are limited, because obviously, we try and be kind, we try and be generous, but unless we do something with this problem of the centre of the wheel, which I'm going to go on to talk about what we do about it later, even our best efforts will be limited. Our efforts to be kind and generous, they'll always be, there'll be something pulling against them all the time. And while we're in this kind of unfulfilled condition, we keep creating and recreating worlds. Our mind just keeps objectifying itself in worlds. While we're meditating there, I, for some reason, remember a long time ago, I hastened to have the bad old days of mild drug taking and just the paranoia. You know that paranoia? I'm sure you don't know, because I'm sure you never do such a thing. But that sort of the paranoia, you create a world of fear, everything's fearful, so our mind is constantly creating worlds. Or more sort of recently, and more sort of hopefully more innocently, like I've increased, actually, not very good advert for meditation, but I'm frightened, at first it says I'm frightened of mice, even saying that, suddenly think, oh God, I hope there's no one here, and I'm something quite proper about mice, and it's sort of increasing, actually, sad to say. And that, like, that phobia kind of creates a world. So I live in one of the communities, well, this will put you off, like, Buddhist communities, but anyway, sometimes we have mice in our community from time to time. And they run around the kitchen, well, not that many, one or two, they run around the kitchen. I don't know why I'm saying all this. Anyway, I've only actually seen a mouse maybe a very, very few times in our kitchen have I seen a mouse. The main place that mouse lives is my imagination. That's the main place that mouse... I've only seen one once or twice for a split second, yeah? But in my the mouse lives in my imagination. And that means that every time I go down the stairs to the kitchen and it's at night or early in the morning, that kitchen is a slightly fearful place. Oh, I've just realised Danielle has just moved into our community. She's looking at me. But do you see what I mean? My mind has made that kitchen a fearful place. There's actually nothing wrong with our kitchen, but because of this mouse that lives in my mind, really, I kind of have to do this whole ritual of, like, I put my hand through the door and I turn the light on and I stamp my feet a bit, and then I feel safe to go in. Do you see what I mean? Like, my mind has made that world. It doesn't really, that's not objectively true. Well, in a sense, there's no such thing as an objectively true kitchen, because everybody else will experience the kitchen another way. I'm sure Danny, who's just moved into our community, thinks this kitchen is like a haven of, like, friendship and everything, So you can't really say there is a thing called the kitchen of, like, some Mahakula community where I live, because everybody's mind will create it in a different way, And who's to say what the real kitchen is? So in a way, that's a kind of fairly innocent example of how we create our world by our mind, but it has more serious consequences if we start if we start acting out of that fear and paranoia and so on, the world will start responding back to, you know, back to us in that way. If out of paranoia we treat everyone as enemies, that's what we'll get back. In contrast to if we're friendly, we'll create a world where people are friendly to us, you know, and we literally live in a happier world, yeah. So our mind is creating the world all the time. We're creating worlds all the time. Some are pleasant, some are painful, but all of them are limited compared to what's possible. Yeah, all of them are limited compared to what's possible while we're unfulfilled and unenlightened. Yeah, even the pleasant is limited. From the point of view of the Buddha would be saying, yeah, that's fine to the pleasant experience, but there's much, much more. There's much, much more. Yeah, there's much, much more. And the image for this unlined, unfulfilled mind is a wheel. That's why we call it the wheel of life. Yeah, it's a wheel. We call it the wheel of life. And in fact, it would be more accurately, it's called the wheel of becoming. And it's called the wheel of becoming because of this business of that we're creating and recreating our world and ourself in a way all the time. Yeah, so it's the wheel of becoming. But the main thing is it's a wheel. It's a wheel. It's going round and round. It's kind of in one dimension. It's not going anywhere. It's kind of, you know, pleasure gives way to pain, then, you know, then there might be more pleasure, but it's kind of, there's a sense of not going anywhere, even if in a sort of ordinary way, there's some progression, you know, we might be learning stuff and so on, but from the point of view of the Buddha, it's not going anywhere in the sense that they're much, much further, much, much, much more to the mind than we realise, yeah? So it's not, well, we're on that wheel of life. We're not really nearly so fulfilled as we could be. We can't really imagine how much more there could be. Sometimes we get glimpses of that, especially if we do go on retreat or through meditation and so on. Yeah, so... the other thing is, as we see from the picture, it's not only is this wheel going round and round and not really going anywhere in the deepest sense, it's like gripped by this monster. And what this monster is representing is the whole thing is overshadowed by impermanence, by death, really. That monster is the Lord of Death. Yeah. The whole thing is overshadowed by death. And that's fearful. That's fearful. If we're, in a funny way, that's another sort of thing. It's a bit like me coming along to the Buddha Center and thinking I didn't have any enemies. That actually to be aware of our fear of impermanence can actually be progress, yeah? My own teacher, our own teacher, those of us who are ordained Bhante Sangharakshita, he says that lack of fear of death often is just simply lack of imagination, yeah? Which I thought was quite good, and I thought it's kind of appropriate to fear death, you know, this thing that's kind of going to happen to all of us. We don't know when. It's probably going to be painful and difficult. It's going to happen to everyone. Will have happened to many of your friends and relatives already, and will happen to us. And I was thinking, do you know that, I don't know where it comes from, some sort of Zen type saying. It says something like, first there's a mountain, then there's no mountain, then there's a mountain. Have people heard that? Oh, well. It's a Zen saying. Anyway, I translated it into this thing about the fear of death, and I thought, first there's no fear of death, Then there's fear of death. Then there's no fear of death. Yeah. So first there's no fear of death. If we haven't got any imagination, if we haven't got any reflective awareness, there's no fear of death. Yeah. Because we just haven't got enough imagination to realise that that's what's coming to us. That we're not frightened of it because we just haven't. We're just too busy enjoying ourselves or something, or we just have cut off from it. So then there's fear, so then that's, in a certain sense, progress. But that's not the end point of Buddhism. It's not trying to terrify us, because there is a moving beyond that fear, and that's what I'm hopefully going to try and take us beyond tonight, yeah? So are you with me so far? Yeah? So while we're on this wheel, as it were, this repetitive, conditioned, unfulfilled, in the fullest sense, unenlightened mindset, not only is it limiting, it's overshadowed by this fear, yeah? And that's represented by this monster gripping onto it, yeah? There is another way to be. That's the message of the Buddha, is there's another way to be that's not on this wheel of life. And that's represented by the image of the Buddha. The Buddha was a historical person who lived and realised the state we called enlightenment. And that's represented by this image, which is deliberately larger than life, is deliberately God. It's sort of trying to show that the human potential is much bigger. I mean, it's only a little bit larger than life. The one at our retreat centre, Vajrasana, is even bigger. But really, it should be infinitely big, because it's trying to show the human potential is infinitely bigger than we could have imagined, yeah? It's painted gold to show that that state is radiant, but really it should be, I don't know, somehow painted with something that shines, you know. It should be lit up from the inside and sort of shining at us to sort of show that this state of enlightenment is kind of is luminous, yeah, and radiating compassion, radiating bliss and joy, and that everybody who kind of came in its orbit would be touched by that. So you've got the wheel of life, and then you've got the Buddha, and what we're interested in is, well, how do you make that transition from one to the other? And the model we've been talking about this week is the image of the spiral path, yeah? So you move from this wheel of life, you sort of step onto, as it were, the spiral path that leads to fulfillment, yeah? And the spiral path is the image given for the mind that's not reactive, the image for the mind that's creative, yeah? So the creative mind isn't conditioned, it's spontaneous, it's free, it's strong, because it doesn't depend on outside stimulation or outside outside agents to make it happy. It's its own inner source. It's a sort of fountain of just inner resource, yeah? The creative mind is the mind that always knows how to respond, that always knows what's the best next step, that isn't worried about what people think, it's just free to be, just freely expressing itself, not in a kind of reckless sort of way. I don't mean a sort of, oh, I'm so expressive type sort of thing. It's not expression just for the sake of it. It's not just being different just for the sake of it. You know, the creative, you know, somebody could be operating off their creative mind and just seem to be sitting quite still. You know, they wouldn't be sort of, doesn't necessarily mean they'd be kind of wild and wacky, you know. But sort of free in a sense of not conditioned, not dependent, yeah? I find that very, very attractive, a very, very attractive notion to think that it would be possible to develop that amount of inner resource that that wouldn't be dependent and also wouldn't be unduly caring what people thought. You'd care what people thought in the sense of you wouldn't want to upset people. You wouldn't be deliberately doing things to disturb them, but you wouldn't care in that sort of terribly self-conscious, oh my goodness, what do people think of me, you know. The creative mind would never be troubled by guilt, for example, in the neurotic sense, there would be remorse of a sort of sense of knowing when you've done something that hadn't lived up to your ideals, but there'd be no sort of neurotic guilt, no kind of, yeah, no fear in that sense, no fear of sort of censure in that sense, yeah. So that's that. So you, in the week, that's how we've been talking about it. We've been talking about sort of stepping off the wheel, as it were, onto the spiral. Another perhaps better way to think of it, rather than the wheels of sort of place you leave behind and step onto the spiral, is to think that these are different and distinct modes of operating. Yeah? So we can be operating reactively or operating creatively. I wanted to say that because when we're talking about the danger of saying we're trying to step off the wheel of life, it could easily sound like we're trying to leave life behind. It could easily sound like we're trying to leave the world behind. That's not what we're trying to do. That's not what Buddhism is teaching us. It's not sort of saying you've got to leave the world behind. Certainly not saying you've got to leave life behind. But it's Buddhism, the Dharma's giving us tools to see if we can start to operate in a new way, operate in the world in a new way. And that new way is the creative mode, yeah? And when we do start to operate in that creative mode, the whole structure of our mind changes. It's not just an equal and opposite thing to the reactive mind. It's something much more. It's something much, much more. And it's cumulative and augmentative. A bit like Aravavati was saying in the announcements, that we might even have felt that if we'd been on the urban retreat or we'd been coming to this class regularly, that positive can add to positive. We can find, oh, I'm growing more aware, I'm growing more kind, yeah? It's augmentative like that. That's what I mean when I say the structure of consciousness actually changes, whereas the creative mind hasn't got any, the reactive mind, sorry, hasn't got any progress in it, not real progress in the, I'm hesitating to use the word spiritual, but I'll just use it anyway. The reactive hasn't got any spiritual progress. It might have progress in other ways, whereas the creative mind is only progressive, yeah? It's only progressive. And we've got another talk tomorrow, actually, which will be talking more in detail. Viridak will talk to us more in detail about how that spiral path, that spiral way of operating starts to work. What I want to talk about more tonight is the monster of impermanence and what we're going to do about him. So I was thinking we could say that the monster of impermanence is the monster of reality, yeah? And that from the point, if we're inside, as it were, the wheel of life, from that point of view, if we're inside this reactive mode of being, if we're totally caught up in that, then from that perspective, reality is terrifying. Reality is a monster, yeah? So inside, from inside this, reality is terrifying. Because the wheel of life, this wheel of becoming, what it is, what its purpose is in a way, what it's trying to do is it's an attempt to defend itself against reality. That's, in a way, that's its function, yeah? When we're in that mode, when we're in that reactive mode, we might not be aware of what we're doing, but we're trying to defend ourselves against reality. And remember, we are the wheel of life. It's not that, it's not so much that it's a place we are, it's, it is us. It's a sort of mirror, really, this image. Yeah? It's showing us what we're like most of the time. Just existentially, Buddhism isn't saying like we're bad, you know, for being driven by greed, hatred, and delusion. Buddhism just recognizing that's that just comes with the territory of being human. It's not specially us that are. No, it's not like I'm specially bad because I'm like specially on this wheel of life and I'm specially driven by greed, hatred, and delusion. None of us are especially that, it's just the human condition. That's what it is to be an unenlightened human being. That's just, that just kind of goes with it. That's sort of how we are and sort of why we are. We've sort of created that world, yeah? And we've created a world that's a defense against reality because from this point of view, of being inside it, reality is terrifying, yeah? Impermanence, the fact of death especially, is terrifying. The problem with trying to defend ourselves against reality, and Garbhavati already said this in the first half, well, there's three problems of trying to do this. So the first problem is it keeps us small, yeah, because it keeps us, it just keeps us going round and round in this tight little knot, yeah? So that's the first problem. The second problem is it takes tremendous energy. We don't really realise it does take so much tremendous energy until we stop doing it for a moment. Every now and then, you might stop defending yourself so much. I have experienced this particularly in meditation where I suddenly realise, ah, I don't need to do that thing of keeping sort of defending this sort of me. And it's tremendous relief. And at that point, I realised, gosh, I've been putting so much unnecessary energy into this defence. Yeah, I don't realise I'm doing it until I'm not doing it. Maybe I'll try and give an example to sort of illustrate that. Let me think of an example. I've used this example before, but it's the first one that comes to mind. So I remember once just meditating on the, just following the breath as we do in meditation. And for some reason, I just asked myself the question, what would happen if I wasn't so attached to my breath? If I wasn't so sort of, yeah, if I didn't have this kind of, this is my breath, what would happen if I wasn't so attached to it? And as soon as I asked that question, I almost burst out laughing. I felt a tremendous release of energy because I suddenly realised nothing would happen. Nothing would happen. My breath doesn't need me to be attached to breathe. Yeah, do you see what I mean? It just will breathe. I won't, if I'm not attached to my breath, I won't suddenly drop dead. I didn't realise I was attached to my breath. You don't kind of go about thinking I'm attached to my breath, do you? But suddenly I realised in that moment, oh God, I think I've got to hold on to my breath. It's a funny thing to think, isn't it? It's completely illogical. But it was only when I stopped for a moment, kind of thought, oh, I don't need to be attached to it. I'll just breathe. I won't drop dead. I felt this upsurge of energy. But then it closed down again. But in that moment, I realised, gosh, what a potential that is. The thing is, you can't really force those moments. You can create the conditions for them by sort of meditative reflection, but you can't force them. So we don't realise we're putting all this energy into sort of keeping ourselves together until something sort of gives for a moment. And then we realise, oh, I didn't have to be doing that. And then we realise that there's, I sometimes think it would be like splitting the atom. You know how nobody realised that you could split the protons and neutrons in an atom apart. They just thought that was one thing, the nucleus. And then they realised, oh, you could split it apart. And then there was a nuclear explosion, which wasn't so good news. But the energy, nobody knew there was that amount of energy. they just thought that a proton and a neutron were the one thing. Like, I just think, oh, here's me, and I've got to hold on to myself, but I don't. Am I making sense? Or yeah, sure. Yeah, okay, good. It is quite hard to explain because it's quite, it's kind of a bit like a sort of seeing that often for me it happens more in meditation. So it takes, this keeping ourselves in this wheel takes tremendous energy. So first problem is it keeps us small, yeah? Second problem is it takes tremendous energy. What's the third problem? Gaurav Bhatia already mentioned it. This defense against reality, defense against impermanence. What's the third problem with it? So I tell you, it doesn't work. That's the third problem. It doesn't work. Because sooner or later, reality comes in. And we'll already have experienced this in our lives. We'll already have experienced the reality of, you know, people we really love who've died, perhaps our own ill health. We already will have experienced this, and we've only got more of it to come. Yeah, reality will break in. It will not work to try and defend ourselves against reality. So, but yeah, we keep trying, we keep going round this wheel, we keep trying. So what are we going to do? Yeah, what are we going to do about this? And what has Buddhism got to say that can help us with this? Yeah. So there's three, I've only got 10 minutes left. There's three things, there's three sort of lines of attack, as it were, to this problem, yeah, of what we're going to do. So the first thing is we can try and see more deeply how this way of operating, how this wheel of life, this wheel of becoming is a self-perpetuating story driven by greed, hatred, and delusion, yeah? We can just start to sort of see that, yeah? We can just, it'd probably be in meditation, just, not necessarily in meditation, but that's the way we can sort of penetrate. In a sense, that's what meditation's for. It's, as Gaurav Bhatia was saying, meditation isn't just for calm and isn't just for well-being. It starts off like that, but actually it's for this kind of seeing how that this wheel is just a self-perpetuating story and that there is another dimension of experience that's more real, yeah? So that's the first way. That's why in the first half of the classes all this week on the Urban Retreat, for those of you who have been, we've been trying to look with this meditative seeing, yeah? So that's the first way. Of course, I could say a lot more about that, but I'm going to say most about the third way tonight. So I'm just saying quite quickly about ways one and two. The second way is to allow ourselves to be drawn on by the Buddha, as it were, drawn on by the vision of there's another way of being. And how to do that is just to cultivate ordinary responsiveness. Ordinary responsiveness to beauty, where we see it either in nature, in art, or in the goodness of other people, responsiveness to truth. So we allow ourselves to be responsive to that which is sort of greater, higher, more beautiful. For Buddhists, that would be the image of the Buddha would represent. That's like the utmost truth, beauty, and goodness. Yeah, but actually, it can be anything. There's more true, more beautiful, more good, as it were, than we'd experience in ourselves. We can allow ourselves to respond to that and be moved by it and drawn on by it, yeah? And that's an active thing we can do. Responsiveness is an active thing we can cultivate. So we can allow ourselves to be drawn on. The third way, which I'm going to spend the rest of this little talk talking about, is to see that the reactive mind is the emotional and affective expression of our delusion. You know, saying that this, you know, I said that the basis of this whole thing is greed, hatred, and delusion. Delusion's the deepest of those three. What I want to say very, very clearly is that delusion, as I said, is just part of being human. It's not a moral issue. It's just it's existential, not moral. It's not a blameable thing. We're not bad because of that. It just, as I say, comes with the territory of being human. Yeah, that's very, very important. Otherwise, we start to, I don't know, we start to think it's some sort of value judgment on us. But yeah, we see that being human itself is kind of, being human and being unenlightened, it means sort of circling around a delusion, yeah? And the emotional expression and affective expression of that is the reactive mind, yeah? And that's a closed circle, yeah? So that gives us a tool, because what we can then think of is that what we can do is we can start to expand that circle, yeah? And we can expand that circle by cultivating responsiveness, I would say primarily to other people. It could be responsiveness to, well, all life really, responsiveness to life, but particularly life in the form of other people. So the reactive mind is when we're contracting ourselves around a delusion. The creative mind is a mode of action that doesn't reinforce that delusion, yeah? And this is why we practice, for example, if you've learned the Metta Bhavana meditation here at the center, some of you have learned that, some of you might not have learned it yet, but it's a practice where we cultivate loving kindness, where we cultivate empathy, where we cultivate sort of putting ourselves in another person's shoes. We practice that not just to be a better person, not just to make the world a better place. Make a world a better place is a good thing. But we practice it in order to, well, really, in order to sort of move out of revolving ourselves around a delusion, yeah? To start expanding out from that. That's why we practice generosity as well. And these will be practices at first. We might not always feel like it. Certainly I don't always feel like being kind. I don't always feel like being generous. I don't even sometimes know that that's an option sometimes. I'm so sort of busy sort of in sort of my series of knee-jerk reactions that we're all in. Practicing awareness shows us that we've got the choice, and then we can practice generosity and practice kindness as a way of making quite a radical shift in our being. Yeah, it's radical because reactive mind, again, as Garbhavati indicated in the first half to those of us that were here, will tend to justify themselves. Yeah. We'll always feel justified in a reaction. We'll never feel like, very, very unusual. I think I've only felt it once or twice in my life where I've thought, I'm just going to be bad for the sake of it. You know, usually we don't think, oh, I'm going to be really bad today. Usually we feel we are totally justified. Well, that's, I certainly do. We feel I'm totally justified in what I'm doing, yeah? I'm certainly not a bad person, yeah? So reactions, you see, in my fantasy about myself, reactions will justify themselves. And in a certain sense, on their own level, in a certain sense, reactions sort of are justified on their own level. But if we want to break out of this wheel of just circling round and round, we have to ask more of ourselves. We in a way, you could just say, well, they did this, so I'm doing that, who can blame me? You could say that, and in a way, from a certain point of view, you might even have some justification in that, but it will never move you on to the full potential of your being. I remember an example I often sort of say at this point is something, it was a TV program I saw years ago, I think I was a teenager, I can't even remember what it was, but I remembered it all my whole life, and I remembered what it was there was two groups of people, and actually all these people, something absolutely terrible had happened in their life, like really, really awful things, like, you know, a child had been murdered, or, you know, what even worse things, you know, terrible, terrible things had happened to them. And one half of the people had forgiven and the other half hadn't forgiven. Now, the people who hadn't forgiven, you could sit in a way, you could feel for them. They would say, why should we? You know, this awful, terrible murder or something had happened. And in a way, you think, yeah, fair enough, you know, fair enough. There really is no reason for them to forgive. It's awful what's happened. You couldn't really blame them for not forgiving. And the other half of people had forgiven. But I remembered what I noticed was, although you couldn't, I certainly wouldn't dare to blame the people that hadn't forgiven, their whole, even their physicality looked different. So the people who hadn't forgiven looked tortured, their being looked smaller, tighter. Whereas the people who had forgiven, now they certainly didn't look, the suffering was etched on them, but you could just, basically you could just tell they were freer. You could just tell they were freer, yeah? So in a certain sense, there is, when you take something like forgiveness, there is no, on one level, while from the point of view of the Wheel of Life, there's no reason for it. You're justified not to forgive. You're justified not to be generous. You're justified not to be kind when everybody else has been unkind. But if you want to realise the full potential that's represented by the Buddha, then I'd say that we need to find a way of doing that, yeah? And then that, as soon as we start to look for that way, we move into the creative mode of being. And we take a step towards fulfilling our potential. Our consciousness becomes different, new, renewed, yeah? So we're trying to move from a mode of revolving around our own axis, revolving around there's me in the middle of everything, yeah? Even if it's a bad me in the middle of everything, even if it's a kind of I hate myself me in the middle of everything, there's still me at the middle of everything. We're trying to move from that mode of revolving around our own axis to a mode that's completely different, where we're orbiting around something bigger than ourselves, yeah? And a way to practice this is to put ourselves in situations where more is asked from us, yeah? In actual fact, if only we sort of knew it and we were sensitive enough, we'd see that life itself is asking something from us. I think perhaps that's, you could even say, the beginning of spiritual life, when we realise that life itself has a meaning and life itself is asking something of us. But it can be quite hard to feel that. It can feel maybe possibly a bit abstract. So I would say, like, sort of chunk that down. Put yourself in situations where more is asked for you, even if that more is just, you know, being kind to one person. Yeah, putting yourself in a situation where you're responsible in relation to one person. When we do that, as soon as we start relating to another person, responding to another person, it's like we forget, in a positive way, we forget to circle around ourselves, yeah? And that's a relief, yeah? That's why when we're generous, it feels, we feel good, yeah? Because we've temporarily forgotten to circle around ourselves. We've been taken out of ourselves in a positive way. It's a positive forgetting, yeah? So that will begin as a practice, yeah? Generosity, kindness, and so on will begin as a practice, but if we keep practicing it, it will become more and more second nature. This spiral way of operating will become more and more second nature. And what I want to say is we've all had glimpses of that. We must have had, by virtue of being human, we must have some people in our life, some times in our life, where we sort of forget about ourselves in relation to them. Some people that we really love, that when we're with them or when we're thinking about them, we just want to help them. It's a pleasure to help them. It's a delight to help them. We all must know that. And when we're in that mode, when we're in that zone, that's what I mean by we've forgotten about ourselves, not in a negative way, not in a negative way of forgetting, not in a sort of pushing ourselves aside. It's more like we've sort of forgotten to circle round ourselves. We're free of that. We're temporarily free of that. We've been called out of ourselves by our response to another person. Do you sort of see what I mean? Yeah, yeah. And have people, it's a sort of ordinary human experience, isn't it, to feel that in relation to some people, at least. What we can actively do is try and let that expand to more people, try and practice it so that it starts to expand to more people. And when we forget, when we positively forget to circle around ourselves, then the wheel disappears, yeah? The wheel vanishes, disappears, yeah? And when the wheel disappears, what's the monster gonna do, yeah? The monster disappears as well, actually, because the monster only operates in relation to the wheel, yeah? It's a bit like the monster suddenly realizes they're trying to hold on to the blue sky, but actually it's almost like even the monster becomes the blue sky. The wheel disappears and becomes sort of this sort of luminous blue sky, and in a way the monster becomes the blue sky as well. The monster hasn't got reality anymore because there's nothing to hold on to. The wheel disappears because we've forgotten to circle around ourselves, because we've been pulled out of ourselves by responding to another person who we love. And we can practice letting that love expand to more and more people. And so the wheel disappears, and the monster disappears, and they disappear. They don't sort of disappear into nothingness, they disappear into the blue sky of potential, yeah? And that blue sky of potential condenses into the form of the Buddha. So the Buddha is the condensation of the infinite potential that appears when the wheel disappears. So I've gone a little bit over time, so sorry about that. So I think I'm going to leave it there. So I hope I haven't raised more questions than I've tried to give you. I think I've tried to say something possibly quite ambitious in what I'm saying. But if you've got any questions, you can talk to me afterwards, because I was hoping to have time for questions. But as usual, I've had more to say than I realised. So I leave it there. But yeah, thank you.